And you want some evidence of that claim? Look at the Soviet Union. It was a pretty tough system, right? Must have looked very depressing to people who just marveled at the size of the army, the Red Army, the KGB. No, underneath things were shifting, they were moving, people were getting it. You know, people were having these kind of conversations, and they finally said, screw this, you know? We're not participating in this anymore. The more people do it, the easier it is to do. And then before you know it, that big, huge thing doesn't look so big anymore, and they're all running for cover. That's our opportunity. Now, I'm not saying it's going to have a happy ending. God knows what will rise up in place of the thing that's collapsed. But if we're involved, we can do that much more to make sure that things go the right way. That's the way to look at it. Yeah. And make, you know, the veterans movement, military families, you know, it really is time to reach out, you know, and not be parochial about your politics. You know what I mean? I said it before, I'll say it again. If a guy's more into the Second Amendment than I am, all right, you know, I live in New York City, I don't need a gun, I don't hunt. But I'm not going to, you know, go to the mat over that issue. If the guy believes in my right to own a gun and my right to free speech, then, you know, he's my ally. You know, we're friends, as far as I'm concerned. We're Americans. Yeah. No. Yes. I mean, you know, understand that to some extent, the reality we inhabit is the reality we create. I mean, if you choose to do nothing because you think nothing can be done, then you're right. Nothing can be done because you've chosen to do nothing. I mean, I've done a lot of these events over the last 10 days or so, and I have to say, I wish I saw more kids at them. And, you know, whatever you can do to reach out to students, because they're the ones who are really looking at a bleak future, and, you know, we got to bring them on board. Yeah. The question is, some people say, if this had really happened, it'd be on the news. Because the steam is... Stop me before I kill. Yeah, right. Okay, well, okay. There's that, too. People say he won because people are really stupid. I have a very good response to that. I'm going to have to think about yours. The response to that is, well, then become a fascist. Now, if you think people are so stupid that they can't vote, you really are sort of intellectually and morally obliged to become a fascist, aren't you? You shouldn't pretend that you believe in democracy, because if people are idiots, then you need a strong man to keep order. See what they say to that. Maybe they are fascists. Maybe they'll thank you someday. Maybe when they take over, they'll do you the favor of getting you out of the camp, you know? Now, as far as, you know, the argument that if this was true, I wasn't on the news, you know, all the stuff about weapons of mass destruction was true 4 years ago. Why wasn't that on the news? Wasn't on the news because the news wouldn't cover it. Look at the way Scott Ritter, who knew his stuff, everything he said was right, he's an ex-weapons inspector, he tried to tell the world very publicly, this propaganda about the war is bogus. It's all false. Doesn't mean anything. He was condemned, ridiculed. Where was the media then? The fact is, the media does not cover everything that happens. And then, you know, if you come up with some really lurid specifics, like the fact there were a couple of break-ins in Ohio before the election. Oh, this was one of them was reported in one newspaper, Lucas County Democratic headquarters, which is where Toledo is. There was a break-in at the Democratic County headquarters. They stole only computer files and computers. Okay, this was reported in the Toledo Blade. Period. And then I found out quite by accident that the office of a consultant I can't remember his name. It's in the book. In Akron, who worked closely with the Democratic Party, his office was burglarized, only computers taken. And it was all election security stuff. It wasn't reported anywhere. Okay, did that not happen? Is it a lie? No, it happened. They didn't cover it. People, when they say that, they really mean something else. They really mean, I don't want to go there, is what they mean. Okay? Well, I mean, at a certain point, people have to make that decision for themselves. The sad truth of the matter is that it takes a collision between the propaganda and your own experience to wake you up. Sometimes that is a horrible collision. Sometimes you lose somebody. Sometimes you got a kid in Iraq, you know? Or maybe it's something as mundane as having to cut back on your food supply because you need to buy medicine. Whatever it is, if people think they're unaffected by it, then they'll sail along in denial. But, you know, like, unfortunately, that can't go on forever. That's why this project of theirs is doomed. You can't have a faith-based government. It's going to run into reality. This one already did. And if the press were honest, we'd see this every day. They've hit the wall. Yes, in the back. He quoted Daniel Bornstein's book, The Image, which makes the point, it's kind of pre-McLuhan, makes the point that image becomes reality, replaces reality. This is around 1959. And the man here is worried that they can succeed in doing that through control of the media. They can consistently deny reality and exalt the image. Well, they think they can do that. And it is a concern that they can do it for as long as they can do it, but they can't do it now. They're not doing it now. It can't go on. You can't keep doing it. This is just the cardinal rule of propaganda. Once authorities become discredited in the eyes of the mass audience, those authorities are finished. That's what happened to Nixon, okay, after Watergate. He was finished. Nothing he did could redeem him in people's eyes. Same has happened to Bush. Nothing he does will redeem him in people's eyes. He's crossed that line. Now, things that they should have pointed out and deplored 3 years ago, like that ridiculous performance when he was in, you know, military drag on the Abraham Lincoln, you know, they should have just gone to town on what a joke that was. Instead, they were all acting like, you know, moonstruck teenagers, these media people. Oh, he looks great. Oh, look how he looks so good. And it wouldn't work now. It wouldn't work now. It's over for them now. Because finally, too many people have died. Too many families are angry. Too many people are going broke. You know, too many people feel the pinch of the state. You know? It's enough already. Like, the American people are not theocrats. We got rid of those bozos in Dover, Pennsylvania. Right? Wanted to force... I mean, that consensus, you know, that resurgent rationality, that's reality too. And that reality reasserted itself. So I would be optimistic. I think my book, as frightening and angering as it is, I think the book is profoundly exhilarating because you know why? It makes clear that we did not elect this guy. You know, this guy is not the choice of the American people. And abroad they were all saying, you know, can... You know, X million Americans be that dumb? You saw those headlines. Well, the answer is no. We're not that dumb. Right? And I think we should make that very clear to the rest of the world. You know, we're not as bad as you think. Well, I know about Rush. She asked about legislation intended to modify the Help America Vote Act. I know about Rush Holt's bill. Rush Holt wants a bill that will provide a paper trail, right? I'm not a big fan of the paper trail. Because it's not a panacea. It doesn't solve the problem. It makes things a little better, you know, as a piece of paper. But since the piece of paper in your hand can say something different from what the machine is saying internally, I don't take a whole lot of comfort from that. I think that's like a baby step in the right direction. I think we need paper ballots and a ban on private vendors. Period. Period. That's it. You know? That's it. Why, you know, think about it. Now here we have to get down to first principles again. How on earth can we justify a democracy using private property to count votes? You know, how can we justify a private corporation with partisan connections manufacturing sensitive voting equipment? That's completely ridiculous. And if you put it that way to the people, I can't imagine the news doing that now, but if you did, they would agree. You have a conversation with a Canadian or anyone from a real democracy, and you tell them we have these companies operating, they're stunned. This is incredible. It's like we told them we burn witches here. You know? It can't be allowed anymore. It's happening now because we forgot or never really took in that it happened then, right? The Winter Soldiers, most Americans didn't even know about that at the time, right? I mean, everybody should see that. Now, this movement, this administration, I think can be understood. Next, you're next. It can be understood in the following way. It's a kind of virulent reaction against the 60s and 70s, right? There's this whole mythology that's been built up. You know, movies like Forrest Gump. I mean, every Hollywood politicians. It was a time of madness, screaming in the streets, a lot of violence, and a little minority of crackpot kids forced the nation to become humiliated. That's just complete and utter crap. The people of this country turned against that war, right? And they didn't turn against the war because Walter Cronkite started to look ironic about it. They turned against the war because of the casualty rate, because too many Americans had died. And there was a huge collision between the propaganda from the Pentagon and that reality, right? You can't spin that shit away. You can't spin it away, right? Now, one of the things we have to do, and here again, it's a matter of being unapologetic. You know, we believe in reason. We're Americans. We don't run from the truth. We believe in our history. And that doesn't mean, you know, the grade school propaganda version of our history. That doesn't mean, well, first the Puritans came, and then the framers came, and they all had a big picnic together, and they started the Constitution, and we were wonderful from then on. This country has always been in political struggle from the beginning. To try to live up to the ideals in the Bill of Rights is no mean feat. It's hard. It involves constant, endless struggle. And the framers were at odds with each other about this. They were at odds with themselves about this. They owned slaves. It's really hard to live up to those ideals. It's extremely difficult. Well, part of living up to those ideals means facing the truth about your own past. You know, America has done horrible things. That doesn't mean America's a horrible place. That doesn't mean America's a bad idea. On the contrary, it means that the idea of America is more important than ever. And all the horrible things we've done have, in a sense, been violations of that ideal, you know? So let's just cut the bullshit. Let's stop listening to Lynn Cheney and Joe Lieberman saying, you know, no, you hate America. You're dwelling on the dark side only. You know, those, pardon the cliche, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. Everybody knows that cliche. How about thinking about it for 5 minutes? In Iraq today, we're using chemical weapons. We use chemical weapons in Fallujah. This is reported all over the world, hardly here. Not only use chemical weapons in Fallujah, but before the assault on Fallujah, there were large public baptismal ceremonies by the Marines. Okay? There were guys with rosaries wrapped around their gun barrels. There were tanks that said New Testament written on the side. This is a religious war, friends. This is what this, not just about oil, it's not just about Halliburton. Yeah, it's about them too. But there is a lunacy to it. We're right back to square one. We're right back to 1096. Okay? So if we believe in this country, we believe in making sure that that stuff doesn't happen. Because if there's anything the framers did agree on, it was in the value of putting a religiously inflected society and history behind us. Okay? And basing things on reason. Right? Well, yeah, I mean the machinery was set up, was put in place to reelect Bush. There's no question about that. You know, in 11 states that we know of, these machines routinely flipped votes from Kerry to Bush. I never heard of a machine flipping Bush votes to Kerry, and even if there were 10 of them, you know, it doesn't count because they all did the other thing. I mean, they were all, you know, in the 2002 election, this is where Max Cleland was deprived of his Senate seat. Diebold employees came in the dead of night before the election and put software patches in all the machines. This is completely illegal. It's completely improper. And then there was this big upset victory by Saxby Chambliss, you know. I mean, there's just example after example after example. So whether Bill did it on his show or not, it is true. Okay, it's absolutely true. Well, let me say one thing about that. The neocon problem is actually part of a dual problem, and that critique overlooks the other half of the problem. The neocons have a tremendous amount of influence in, like, State Department circles, you know, in the upper reaches. That's true. And there are a number of senators who are neocons, absolutely. But what gives the neocon position its legs is the fact that it works very closely with the Christian Zionist movement. Christian Zionist movement, it's about Israel. A very interesting relationship. I wrote about this in my last book, Cruel and Unusual, talks about this weird relationship. See, I mean, on the left, there's a tendency to seize on the neocon thing, and it's often slightly inflected with anti-Semitism, like there's this Jewish cabal running the government. The problem with that argument, aside from the fact that it's anti-Semitic, is that it
it completely overlooks the crucial participation of the Christian right and its Zionism. There are 20 million American Christian Zionists in this country. People like Tom DeLay, for example, are not Zionists because Louis Libby told them to be. They're Zionists because they seriously believe that it is in the book of Revelation that the Jews will all return to Israel. They'll take up their original biblical borders, Greater Israel. DeLay has said there's no such thing as a Palestinian. And then when they have taken up their old territory, 144,000 of those Jews will become Christians. This is all in the book of Revelation. And then all the rest of them will fry along with everybody else. Okay? Now that is a tremendously powerful, influential, and lucrative movement that has given tons of money to Israel, that has sent a lot of people over there, and it dovetails frighteningly with the most extreme Zionism in the Likud, because these people have a kind of messianic vision of the Jewish people's destiny. The interesting thing is that the neocons are all Straussians. They all follow the philosophy of Leo Strauss. All of them went to graduate school studying with students of Strauss. Strauss was a kind of Machiavellian. Strauss believed in religious government, not because he was pious. Strauss was an atheist. He believed in religious government because he realized that religious government makes people docile. It's the most effective at ruling the multitudes, provides them with enough opium. Now, the interesting thing is that the neocons and the Christians, their relations are extremely close. I mean, really close. It isn't just that they're using each other. I mean, they really are joined at the hip. And when you're talking about somebody like Condi Rice, you're talking about somebody who's in both camps at once. Condi Rice is a religious maniac. You know, she said, the world is a messy place. Somebody has to clean it up. She said that recently, you know? And she's you know, aside from being a religious wing nut, she's a complete neocon as well. Well, they're completely incompetent. I mean, they're ideologues. They're as incompetent as Mao's people. Remember when Mao decided that China would become a great steel-making power? You weren't there, I know. But, you know, this is worth looking. Is it when a country loses its mind, terrible things happen. So Mao said, well, now China's going to be the great helmsman. Said, China will now be a steel-making power to rival the U.S., so all the villages shall now make steel. They didn't know how to make steel, okay? So they made all this crappy steel that nobody would buy. You know, it was brittle, it bent, it was crummy steel, and nobody planted any crops. So guess what happened then? It was an enormous famine, right? Now, we don't have any right to feel superior to them. To the extent that we allow these lunatics to run this country, we cannot look down on Red China, right? So anyway, revolutions, you know, evil or good, often involve a convergence of different interests. And the Zionist thing is really complicated by, you know, extreme Christian religious ideology on the one hand, and then Straussian Machiavellianism on the other, and then Jewish messianism, and it's, you know, the whole thing, please, just take it away. Yeah. You all hear that question? You know, there's media reform and there's electoral reform, and I completely agree. The two are inextricably linked. For example, we talk about campaign finance reform. We obviously need that. But campaign finance reform is one with media reform, because you know who gets all that money? You know who gets all that money for campaigns? The media. The media get it. That the money is spent on media time so that they can buy a lot of TV and radio propaganda. So is it any wonder that the corporate press doesn't report on the issue? That's their money, okay? So, you know, more generally speaking, of course, we can't have a functioning democracy if we don't have the right to vote, and we can't have a functioning democracy if we don't have a free and independent press. You know, to get the independent media we now have to cover these issues, you got to pester them. But we have got to work toward... See, saving the country from Bush-Cheney is like step one. You know, we got to reclaim the whole democracy. We've let the whole thing slide for decades. You know, let's say the left. We took a detour into multiculturalism after the Vietnam War, where all of a sudden being on the left meant honoring different outgroups. You know, it was balkanizing society. There was no class interest. there was African Americans, there were Hispanic Americans, you know, there's gender, there's that. That completely disempowered the left. It ceased to become an effective force, and it became a lot of special pleading. And it made the left terribly vulnerable to charges on the right that we were all into coddling certain groups, because there was no interest at all in the white working class or the white middle class, for that matter. No economic questions. This has something to do with the fact that the big liberal foundations like Ford and Rockefeller and Carnegie started funding multicultural stuff big time, and it ended up just wrecking, you know, any kind of a progressive critique. See? So we got a lot of... Meanwhile, while we were doing that, the right was, you know, running for school boards, running for the House in different states, taking over the political system, pouring millions of dollars into the likes of the Heritage Foundation, paying for media time, training people to appear on TV, buying TV time, changing the regulations for media. So now all of a sudden, the whole media system is owned by like four or five companies. There's no fairness doctrine anymore, and we have Rush 24 hours a day. I mean, that's what's happened. So because of our detour into multiculturalism, the right got the government and the left got the English department. Okay? So we got a lot of making up to do, and that, central to that, crucial to that, is media reform. And we have to redemocratize the media. We have to break these cartels down. We have to build up a genuine public media system. We don't have one. It should be local as well as national. You know, it should be fully public. We have to re-regulate broadcasting so that they are forced to do certain things for the community in return for getting all that free use of the spectrum. I mean, there's just tons of stuff we got to put back into place. We went wrong in 1934 when we made the decision to have an advertising-driven media system. It was the Communications Act of 1934. There'd been a big debate. We don't learn this in school. There'd been a 5-year national debate over whether we should have an advertising-driven system or a British-style system where people pay license fees and there'd be no advertising. So in 34, you know, Roosevelt and the Congress signed the Communications Act. They tried to split the difference by setting up a commercial system that would be advertising-driven, but it would be heavily regulated. So while the advertisers would have tremendous power and while they would make buckets and buckets of money and pay nothing for use of the airwaves, they would have to do political news, community affairs, children's programming, religious programming. You know, one of the reasons why televangelism has swept the country is because there's no more regulation insisting that, you know, religious programming get a certain amount of time. Those shows are all gone, right? Now the system's completely corrupt. There used to be caps on station ownership and only so many minutes of commercials per hour, you know. It's all gone. And we're suffering for that, because the media has pretty much moronized us. That's not a permanent condition, okay? That can be reversed. That's the miraculous thing about, you know, people. You treat them like human beings, they act like human beings. You talk up to them, they understand. You treat them like trash, they'll act like trash, you know? So we have to have media reform. It's absolutely crucial. Thank you very much.
That was Professor of Media Studies Mark Crispin Miller of New York University speaking earlier this month in Portland, Oregon, about his new book, Fooled Again. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, or WMRW Warren.
Thank you for your time and for believing in the cause. I only have a minute, there's a vote on the hill. It's time to pick some fights and have them out on the floor. They want to privatize and voucherize our lives even more. some people down. A cup of coffee and a piece of pie we shared. We agreed on everything, wouldn't you know? Big oil, big media, big insurance, gotta go.
Leave No Millionaire Behind CD. The obvious question is, why don't the Democrats challenge the rigged elections? Don't they want to win? Are they just spineless? Or do they believe the elections were honest? Consider another possibility, that the party leadership won't challenge them because they have no alternative plan that can save the profits of Wall Street and corporate America without having a police state at home and an empire abroad. Last week, we heard how a Pentagon consultant explained the military's preparation for the future, how it was planning on suppressing rebellion from billions of people destitute as a result of corporate globalization, whose needs won't be met by capitalist markets, because markets only meet the needs of those with the money to buy. Notice the continual mergers of corporations, the accelerating consolidation into fewer, larger entities running leaner and meaner. They are positioning themselves to market to the perhaps 30-50% who can pay and abandon the rest of the population to the tender ministrations of the military, the police, and the prisons. And as we have also reported, the Pentagon is researching ethnic-specific chemical weapons. What other purpose than genocide could motivate such research? Billions of people are not needed as workers and are too poor to be consumers in the market. In other words, from the capitalist standpoint, from the fascist standpoint, they are useless. The ruling class has done the math. Because the Democrats are also a ruling class party, as our next guest will explain, they won't address the core problem, the economic order, the paradigm of property, profit, and growth, which are environmentally unsustainable and unable to eliminate poverty, because great wealth in one place creates poverty in others, a topic also covered on previous programs. Solutions exist, but no politician who wants to be, quote, credible, or who wants to remain alive for that matter, may challenge the distribution of wealth. If you understand that preserving the wealth of the wealthy is the government's top priority and not, for example, rescuing a bunch of poor people from the roofs of their flooded houses, then a lot which seems like madness or incompetence becomes predictable. In our final segment, Mike McCormick interviews Paul Kivel, the author of the new book, You Call This Democracy?
Paul Kivel is an activist, a trainer, a writer, and a violence prevention educator. He has authored numerous books, including Boys Will Be Men, Raising Our Sons for Courage, Caring, and Community, and Uprooting Racism, How White People Can Work for Racial Justice. And he's here to talk about his new book, You Call This a Democracy, Who Benefits, Who Pays, and Who Really Decides. Let me begin and ask you, what was your motivation in writing your book, You Call This a Democracy?
Now, I've been doing work around social justice issues for a long time, and I've been noticing that a lot of us are working on particular issues, particular campaigns, particular environmental issues, male violence issues, housing issues, a range of issues. And very often, though, we're doing those with a very limited framework, not really understanding how the larger system of power, violence, class works. And so we do that work without building a long-term understanding in the community about what the struggle is really about, the fact that we do have a ruling class and a power elite, and that these issues are interconnected, and we have to be working together, seeing how our issue connects to other issues. In the history of this country, we have a myth of democracy, that it's a democratic country, there's equal opportunity, that everybody has, it's a level playing field. And we don't even have a vocabulary for talking about, the phrase ruling class doesn't roll off our tongues very easily. But in fact, we have always had a ruling class in the United States, a top 1% of the population that controls anywhere from 40 to 50% of the financial wealth of the country, that makes the decisions or designates who makes the decisions that influence our lives. So unless we're clear about how that whole system works, we're never going to actually be able to accomplish large-scale social change.
Talk about some of the history of the ruling class in this country. I think a lot of people assume we left that behind on the shores of England when we sailed over.
The people who started the country, the what we call the Founding Fathers, were very much a subset of the British ruling class. They either came over with great wealth, or they were given land and the opportunity to build wealth in that early period. They set up very hierarchical societies in the early colonies. They were an elite group. And then they wrote the Constitution for themselves, basically. They said that only rich white men can vote. And at that point, they were talking about, by rich, anybody who owned property. That was about 10% of the population. So that meant that the Constitution was written to exclude 90% of the people who they considered part of the population of the United States. So when they said all men are created equal, they meant white men with wealth who they knew, who were in the networks of the people that they talked to. And so that's continued on, and the ruling class has changed dramatically over time. Different kinds of industries have risen, different kinds of formations as the country expanded. But the people making the decisions have always been a small elite in this country. Now, what happened originally, and I think this is a really important piece, was that the ruling class, the men who were rich and powerful, were also the direct decision makers, because it was a small enough society that they actually also ran the businesses and the farms and the plantations and the slave industries. And as the country grew, there needed to be still people in charge, but there was a much larger ruling class. So that 1% of the population expanded, and there began to be more of a concentration of – today we have about 7,000 to 10,000 white Christian men predominantly who are in the top of run the corporations, the political offices, the criminal justice system, the foundations, the think tanks, the cultural institutions. And though that smaller group is really a power elite, they're the ones that make the decisions to the benefit of the ruling class.
So would these be the people that are on the boards of large corporations, for instance?
Some of them are on the boards. More often, they're the actual directors, the CEOs of the major corporations. They're the tops of the political parties. They're the ones who are running the foundations and think tanks and major cultural institutions, major media companies, things like that. Below them, there's a whole class of people who are really the managerial class, the next, what I would call maybe about the next 19% of the population. They don't have nearly the wealth or the power, but they carry out the management of those institutions. They're the just below the top rungs. They're the ones that are actually the day-to-day operations, really. You know, if you look at the ruling class and the managerial class together, they own most of the financial wealth of the country. And so together, they really are the owning classes. And that's 20% of the population. The rest of the other 80% of us are really dividing up only about 9% of the financial wealth of this country. That's how extreme the inequality is becoming in the United States.
So talk about the tools that these people, the power elite, use to keep themselves in power.
One is the Constitution itself, which was set up to protect private property, to protect wealth, to set up an electoral system that, again, made it much easier to influence political decisions. The second tool, the major tool, is the corporation itself, which was really became a major factor in the late 1870s, 80s, 90s, and really is what we see in our communities. That's the visible decision-making body that comes in and drives out small businesses, moves manufacturing overseas, puts toxic waste in our communities. It limits the liability. It limits the visibility of the actual decision makers. It concentrates tremendous wealth and power in a very small number of hands. And then when there is conflict or when they're in, you know, the ruling class is not unanimous. It's a large group. There's lots of differences of opinion and strategies. When things come up between them, then the court system is set up to enhance and protect their interests, but also to settle disputes between them. Well, we saw that in the 2000 election where the courts stepped in and it was basically a decision between two ruling class white Christian men about who was going to be president. And I'm not saying that there's no difference between the Democrats and Republicans, but they are both ruling class parties and they both share much more common interests than they don't. And the court stepped in and decided which one of them was going to be president.
So some people would say this view of a ruling class is very conspiratorial. You know?
Well, it's not in a couple of senses. First of all, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people don't sit in a dark room in the back of the office, you know, over smoky tables, making plans to take over. First of all, they are public. Not everything they do is legal, but they are working through legitimate channels, legal channels, public channels. Many of them know of others. They're in common networks. They travel in certain places. They vacation in certain places. They go to certain conferences. They read the same media. And so there's a common culture, but a lot of them don't know each other. A lot of them are not real visible. So it's by no means a conspiracy, but it is an elite. It is a powerful network of And when I say predominantly white males and predominantly Christian, there's a few women, there's a few people of color, there's a few Jews and other non-Christians, but primarily the culture and the dominant backgrounds and genders are white male Christian in those networks. We can see some of them in the government, people like Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and people like that who are the power holders in the government. And we can look in various other places in the society and, you know, some of them are very visible. Some of them are very, you know, keep very low profiles.
And they do that by choice?
I assume so.
Talk a bit about more, again, of the infrastructure and the different tools that the power elite would use to keep themselves in place. You mentioned, how about the media? What is their role in all this?
Well, the power elite are the ones at the top of the media corporations, really. And many of the media corporations are actually larger multinational corporations that have media arms at this point. Companies like GE, for instance, things like that. The media has been consolidated. It's monopolized by six or seven major multinational corporations. The power elite is very much at the top of making decisions and making sure that what people hear is consistent with the messages that they want people to hear, one of which is that there really isn't a ruling class, that really is, you know, there's equal opportunity, and if you don't succeed, it's your own problem. And then, of course, the corporations themselves are money generating, so the money goes to the ruling class out of our pockets. But it's not just the media. The ruling class has a vast network of think tanks to develop policy, of foundations to fund the think tanks. Foundations themselves are just a tool to avoid paying taxes to the government, to keep control of that money, and then to sponsor and pay for the projects that benefit that class. A lot of institutions that are part of the network of how power is maintained. The lobbying industry is another arm of how the ruling class and the power elite influence public policy decisions. So the media fits in, you know, is interwoven with many of those aspects. And then the other thing is that there's many ways that they actually keep their money and protect their money. And so some of that is through laws around corporations, rules and regulations. Some of it's around public policy, around taxes, investing, tax dodges, tax havens, tax policies that lower corporate tax rates or lower individual tax rates. We've seen in the last 40 or 50 years a tremendous shift of tax burden onto working and middle-class people and away from the ruling class as tax rates have come down, estate taxes, corporate taxes, personal income taxes, capital gains taxes. In fact, just this week, we've seen another round of shifting money more and more concentratedly into the hands of the ruling class.
Well, so it kind of begs the question then, what can, you know, regular people do to combat this?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that people are doing. People are organizing constantly, and a long history of organizing for economic justice and for racial and gender justice, and we wouldn't have an 8-hour working day. We wouldn't have a 40-hour working week and a weekend. We wouldn't have unions if people hadn't organized at great cost over decades to win some of those gains. We wouldn't have civil rights. People are constantly organizing. I think the one of the main keys, though, is this: it's not about what we do individually. It's how we hook up with other people in larger communities, in larger organizations, because the ruling class is very organized. They may be split on many issues, particularly social policy issues like abortion rights or gay marriage or things like that. But when it comes to their economic interest, they're a powerful example of how people come together strategically across many kinds of differences to protect their interests. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important that we understand the economic framework, is because we often get divided among ourselves because of differences in political interests and strategies, and we get divided by race and gender and sexual orientation. And so unless we have a larger picture of the long-term struggle, we continually are less effective in terms of really pushing for large-scale redistribution of wealth.
Well, in getting back to the media, a lot of people aren't really aware of, when talks about media, you immediately think of, let's say, radio and television and newspapers. But, for instance, things like book companies, you know, that produce the very textbooks that are then integrated into schools is one aspect of conveying ideas to a culture.
Right. And I think that that's part of what, obviously, we're not meant to see, is that the largest media corporations they're not just a TV or movie company or a book publishing company or a cable company or a magazine company, but most of them control many different aspects of media. And so the consolidation is much more dramatic and severe than most of us can see in our day-to-day lives, because the names, it's like going into a grocery store and you see, you know, 10,000 products on the shelves and you see 50 varieties of cereal. Well, there's two or three cereal companies that have given you the illusion that you can buy any of their many different products, and they're really different products and they're really different companies. But in fact, behind that is a tremendous concentration of wealth and power, and the media is the same way.
In addition to, you'd mentioned foundations and corporations, but one of them you have here is elite universities. Would you talk about that?
Right. I think that that's one important piece of the whole project. As the ruling class, you know, and many of the ruling class kind of step back from direct control of major corporations, as the corporation world became much more complex and sophisticated, the ruling class needed a highly trained managerial elite, basically, to run things and to keep money and power, you know, in place. And so the university system, it's clear to everybody that's highly stratified, you know, that Harvard and Yale and the top elite universities are tremendously powerful and rich institutions. If you live in the areas that they are, then you're aware of how much power they control in terms of politics. They have endowments of billions of dollars. We're talking about $10, $20, $30 billion in the endowment. So they also control tremendous money. But their primary purpose is to train managerial and ruling class youth into becoming the next generation of ruling class and power elite people. So there's a tremendous screening that goes on into who can get into those institutions and then who succeeds and actually gets certified to be safe and skilled and professional enough to be able to hold, you know, bits and pieces of the power at the top. You can see the channeling into that from managerial and ruling class families starts with private schools, independent schools, and also elite suburban schools. And those are the two kind of feeding lines into the elite liberal arts universities and the most elite state institutions and on into the graduate schools. And the graduate school programs are really where a lot of the people get sorted out, whether they really have the capability of making fairly autonomous decisions, but within a very rigid set of parameters of thought, a very, you know, acceptance of the common assumptions of a capitalist, imperialist kind of society.
And yet, if you listen to people like Lynn Cheney, the wife of Dick Cheney, vice president, she headed up some committee that said that the universities are breeding grounds for liberal thoughts that are corrupting, you know, the youth of today.
Right. Well, and it's highly ironic. But I think that there is always a tension. I mean, when you do educate people, inevitably some of them actually begin to think independently and critically and, you know, begin to challenge some of the assumptions. And so part of the particularly the graduate school process is to really screen out who is ideologically safe and who is going to be a troublemaker, who is going to ask those questions. And in fact, I think the universities unfortunately do a pretty good job of that screening, so that at that level there's some tolerance for dissent. But when those people get into the law firms, the management firms, the financial systems, the banks, they've mostly been screened pretty carefully about who's actually going to be safe, who's actually going to carry out the reinforce the system, make sure that things operate smoothly.
You can see a trend, at least in my lifetime, where public universities are their funding is getting cut. They're becoming much more dependent on private donations, much more dependent on corporate contributions. Do you see that as further feeding this system?
Absolutely. The university, most of the large universities are corporatized. I mean, they are corporations. They're huge financial entities in their own right. And they are therefore training people to adapt and live in that kind of environment. And of course, we know that as funding is cut back for public education, it limits more and more who gets into. Only 25% of the adult U.S. population has a four-year college degree. I think generally we think that a college degree is open to everybody and it's widely available and widely used. But tremendous numbers of our young people don't make it to graduate high school, and then even more start college and don't finish. So when we're, you know, the screening is really severe at every level, and people get very clear messages early on about where their place is, where they're expected to end up. And that's by race and class in particular. So, yeah, the whole education system is very much a part of how the system is maintained.
A lot of people might be listening to this and saying, well, that's a nice theory, but we live in a representative democracy, and, you know, I regularly vote, and, you know, they would discount this whole power elite thing just on that alone. You know, it was the Constitution is there for all of us. How can you say it's, you know, really benefits this power elite?
You know, that's the myth. That's the ideology we have, that it is democracy. But I think that if you look at the decisions that get made, not the political process, but the decisions, who decides what we eat? Who decides what our neighborhoods look like? Who decides where we work and how much we're paid and what the conditions are? Those are not those are decisions that are made by the corporations in our communities. And if you look at who makes those decisions, we don't vote on that, right? When was the last time you had a vote about, you know, whether there's genetically modified food in your soybeans or corn? When was the last time you got to vote about whether the jobs in Seattle moved to Taiwan or, you know, Mexico? So we have to look at democracy, if it means anything, means making decisions about issues that impact your life. And in almost any respect we can look to in this country, those are not decisions that you and I are getting to make. We actually don't even get to determine who our political representatives, as symbolic as that is, even there, when you look at what it costs to be a candidate in major elections and where that money comes from, even a contribution of $1,000 to a candidate is a huge contribution. Only about 2% of the population makes a contribution of $1,000 or more to a political candidate. And these days, $1,000 is nothing. I mean, if you don't put in $10,000 or $20,000 or $100,000, you're not a player. You don't have input into that political decision. And on top of that, the candidates themselves are mostly very rich, especially senators, representatives. It's not only that they have to raise all this corporate money and therefore beholden and make decisions back to those corporate sponsors, but they themselves end up putting a tremendous amount of their own money in because you have to have that kind of money to run. So there's very little substance behind the myth of democracy in this country. It's really like the Wizard of Oz standing behind the screen. You can just pull the screen back a very tiny little corner and you can see that there's nothing behind it. You know, more people were aware of that in the last couple of elections, where there was even more direct, visible manipulation and disenfranchisement of a large number of voters. But I think it's been true all along, and we need to not just fix the small pieces of the system. We need to fix the larger pieces of that system. Again, I think the subtitle of my book is Who Benefits, Who Pays, and Who Really Decides? And I think that that's a key. Those are the questions we have to constantly be asking, because we're fed all kinds of misinformation from our textbooks to the daily news to the weekly news magazines. The only way to get underneath that is to be asking who really is benefiting from these decisions, however they're framed. Who's going to end up with cash in their pocket? Who's going to pay? Whose pockets is the money going to come out of? And who's really making the decisions? And if we're honest about who's making the decisions, it's not a democratic process. The other thing I think is really important is the democracy is much more than voting once a year or once every 4 years. That democracy is about participating, like I said, in the decisions that impact our lives. That means in our families. That means in our classrooms. That means in our workplaces. That means in our communities. And so we need to be building a culture, all of us, of democracy in our daily lives, because it's a complete illusion that if we vote once every 4 years for a couple of rich white Christian men to whether which one is going to be president, where even if we had a meaningful vote in that process and we had no democracy in the rest of our lives, we wouldn't be building the kind of communities that most of us want to live in. So there's a lot that we need to think about, each of us, in terms of how are we practicing democracy? How are we challenging hierarchy around us? How are we building processes in our, you know, local situations that gives us the practice of democracy, you know, so that we begin to get better at working together at, you know, if you think about the social movements in our history, they came out of people sitting around in groups, in support groups, in critical thinking study groups, in many kinds of cooperatives and collectives and all kinds of democratic processes that were involved in people coming together and thinking about how to build movements for social change. And so one of our challenges today is to reclaim that democratic impulse and put it into our organizing in the community. I also want to just mention that there's a lot of resources on my website, articles, exercises. We have a lot of other books and curricula. And that is just simply www.paulkivel.com. And to really think about these basic questions, who benefits, who pays, and who really decides.
We've just been talking with Paul Kivel. He is author of the new book, You Call This a Democracy? Who Benefits, Who Pays, and Who Really Decides?
And the interviewer is Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle. Kivel discussed how a managerial and professional class is needed to keep the system running, and the role of higher education in producing these people. What passes for opportunity in America is the chance to compete for a slot in this top 20%, or for the lucky fewer, to aspire to the highest levels of the ruling class. To this extent, America is a meritocracy. Those who show skill and dedication to serving and advancing the interests of the ruling class, who reinforce and uphold the system, may rise into it from humble beginnings. But no matter how educated they are, the other 80% face limited choices, and the ruling class knows that if you tell a bunch of people with college degrees that they are stuck flipping hamburgers, this is a recipe for trouble. That is why they keep building prisons, not colleges. Why do teachers from the earliest grades use a curve grading system? Wouldn't you, as a teacher of a group of students, want 100% of them to master the knowledge you're trying to convey? If mastering knowledge was the goal of education, grading would be pass-fail only. But the educational system is about sorting people into slots in the hierarchy of scarcity that the economic system creates. And educating more people only widens the pool of competitors for the few good slots. It does not create more opportunity for the whole. Last year, I read a book on the program called Disciplined Minds, written by Jeff Schmidt, which is a comprehensive analysis of this system of sorting and culling to create a docile professional class. I strongly recommend you get a hold of it. Just Google Disciplined Minds. This and all our previous programs, including the readings of Disciplined Minds, are archived in MP3 at our website, www.unwelcomeguests.org. Email me through the website if you need help finding something. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Another brave man.